Calling someone a domestic terrorist and an assassin is not the slip of the tongue. It's not an incautious mischaracterization. It seems to be a textbook example of intentional defamation from the bully pulpit of the government to justify a murder.
Right. And to say it without, you know, without any sense of evidence that it's the case.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avalon, author, historian, journalist, executive. And the purpose of this podcast, you know the drill, is to focus on trying to find solutions to the problems we face, not simply endlessly fixating on the many serious problems themselves. And one of the most serious problems we face is the corruption, the violence, the lack of accountability from the Trump administration. You know the four C's, right? Cruelty, chaos, corruption, and costs. Those are the four issues that Democrats should be talking about. Indeed, all Americans of good faith who are trying to redeem something constructive out of the disaster we're living through today. Well, our guest this week is Michael Waldman. He runs the Brennan Center for Justice at New York Law School. And he's just put out 9 specific anti-corruption measures that Americans can and should pursue so that we can actually rein in some of these abuses and not repeat history. We're going to talk about Minnesota, about whether the families of the victims can sue for defamation, why the attorney general is trying to demand voting records in exchange for the implicit stand down of ICE. And we're going to talk about those 9 specific anti-corruption measures because they are far reaching and they're one way to unfuck America at this moment. Michael, it's good to see you.
Great to be with you.
All right. I want to talk with you about the downstream effect of the bloodshed in Minneapolis. This is a horror show for Americans, a second American citizen being murdered by ICE in a general pattern of ICE agents acting above the law. Among the lawless actions, though, is the background noise, a repeated threat by some members of the administration, perhaps most notably Stephen Miller, that Donald Trump, in creating civil disturbances, will have a excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act. I want to just walk folks through what that is and how it could be used and how it could be stopped, if at all.
So the story you tell is exactly right. This is a real inflection point in many ways for the country. We're all seeing what's going on there. It's basically been the invasion of an American city by federal forces. President Trump and Stephen Miller and others over the months have threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act. This is one of those dusty laws that have been on the books since the 1700s, 1800s, that is an exception to the general rule that you cannot use the military domestically for domestic policing and other purposes. It's been used from time to time, always in recent decades with the consent of the local government, because things have gotten out of control. Things have gotten out of hand. So in Los Angeles in 1992, when there were riots after the acquittal of the police officer who beat Rodney King, dozens of people were killed and the military was sent in as part of restoring order. Why hasn't President Trump used this already? He threatened to do so during the George Floyd protests in 2020. It gives him a lot of power. It doesn't require federalizing the National Guard the way he has been doing in other states. I think the reason he hasn't used it is because he thinks if he does, the courts will block him from using it, and that would actually weaken his power.
So there is a judicial backstop to this power to essentially call martial law.
Not usually very much of a backstop. Usually the courts are very deferential to the executive, to the president, in the use of this. There's plenty of past court cases that show that deference. But in this case, in this instance of this president, courts have been stepping up in ways they have not before. One thing that could push him to use the Insurrection Act was a ruling from federal courts, federal appeals court, in Chicago, saying they could not use the National Guard because there was no insurrection, there was no chaos, there was no reason to use the National Guard, to federalize the National Guard. That, in a sense, could push Trump and Miller and that cabal to using something like this, which has fewer fetters on it. But you could once again get the court saying, well, the problem is there's no insurrection. And if there's chaos, if there's violence, if there's stuff that cannot be dealt with by local law enforcement, it's because of the lawless acts of ICE, of CBP, not because people are out there rampaging, but because it's the federal forces that are actually the source of violence and chaos. So I think that they've had some reason to hold back. They haven't done it. And I think it's because they know that they could very possibly get a court ruling that really clips the wings of presidents on using the Insurrection Act.
Or they think they've got one shot and now's not the right time. I will say, as someone who's a close watcher of the Supreme Court, author of a book on the court, this is the first time I've heard you seem sort of sanguine to positive about the possibility of this conservative court doing a brushback pitch to Donald Trump. Yes, I recognize that just happened in Chicago, but this would be
a big one. I didn't say Supreme Court.
Oh, that's fair.
I said federal courts, and these things have not gotten up to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court did a few weeks ago issue that shadow docket order that upheld the idea that they couldn't use the National Guard in Illinois. And look, I think there's plenty of reason to think that this Supreme Court has noticed Donald Trump's plunging poll numbers, the growing unpopularity of this assault on all these American cities, the notion that they are merely, you know, Olympic figures contemplating the law is always absurd, but it's especially absurd now. And I think the atmosphere has shifted enough that could affect what they do.
Well, on one level, that's disappointing. On another level, that's reassuring. Let's talk about this Justice Department. One of the sinister aspects of what's been occurring in the siege of Minneapolis is Attorney General Pam Bondi essentially offering an off ramp, saying, hey, you know, we'll stand down. Just give us all your data, voter data. This one thing has nothing to do with the other. Why is Trump's Justice Department trying to link them? Why are they trying to get voter data from Minnesota?
Part of me thinks she may have just wanted to get some of Kristi Noem's glory and get in the game. But it was really outrageous.
It is that petty, but not only, yeah.
After days in which the person who was killed by ICE, Alex Pretty, the ICU nurse for the VA, was smeared as a domestic terrorist, as an assassin intent on mayhem. This was an outrageous statement that didn't get as much attention, but was really outrageous. She wrote a letter to Governor Waltz of Minnesota that went on and on about violence in Minnesota and lawlessness, and then said there is, quote, a solution. And one of them is turn over your sensitive voter data files to the Justice Department. Now, she didn't say we will pull our bully boys out if you do that. But that was the strong implication, officials in Minnesota certainly thought that's what it meant. Steve Simon, who was the very well-respected Secretary of State there, said that it was basically a ransom demand, and he said no. And it has nothing, one has nothing to do with the other. There's no connection of any kind to immigration issues on the one hand and this quest for voter rolls on the other. Why are they trying to get these voter rolls? This is part of a broad effort by the administration across the country to hoover up all this data from the states on their voter rolls. We've said we think it's part of a broad campaign to undermine the midterms. And we don't know
Help
for
explain
sure.
Explain to folks why you think that's a credible claim, because you know, Pam Bondi can be both petty and sinister at the same time. So look like?
There is an all of government effort to undermine the midterms. And this is really unusual. This is the first time I'm aware of in American history that the federal government has intervened in this way. It ranges from Donald Trump issuing an executive order in March of last year, purporting to take personal control of much of the election system, purporting to decertify all the voting machines, purporting to require that people produce a passport, not even a birth certificate, but a passport to register to vote using the federal form. And presidents have no power to do this. Presidents have no power over elections. They are run by states. Congress can pass laws, but presidents and the Justice Department, too, have no power in this way. one of the things they have been demanding of states all across the country is that they turn over their voter lists with sensitive information to the Justice Department. We know of 44 states that have received these demands. Most of them have said no. Some of them have started to say yes. And it's not entirely clear why they're asking for all this data, but I think that it's likely that they will want to use it to say, aha, finally, we have proof that there's lots of illegal voters. It isn't true, but they'll make that claim. It could be used to undermine confidence in election results when they happen, put pressure on states to purge voters from the voter rolls. You do want states to clean up their voter rolls. That's a good thing. But there's been a lot of pressure from this Justice Department to do so in a way that's going to kick a lot of eligible voters off the rolls and so on. And so it was both outrageous to link it to the killings and the violence in Minnesota and outlandish in its basic premise that there's a need for the federal government to collect all this data. We have gone to court at the Brennan Center and others to say this is not right. Two courts so far have said that the Justice Department doesn't have the right to ask these states for this stuff. It's just one among many fronts in this fight over the election that's going to unfold between now and November.
Keep an eagle eye out for it, folks, and because this is sinister and unprecedented stuff.
I want to make really clear, I do think strongly we will and we can have free and fair elections. People ask me all the time, can Trump cancel the elections? The answer is no, he can't. Important. But we'll all have to fight for it.
That's right. This is the fight to vote. But I know you get asked that all the time. Can Trump cancel elections? The answer is he cannot. Although that doesn't mean they won't try in some way, shape, or form.
If I want to, but he can't.
You mentioned something in passing. Stephen Miller, immediately, of course, blamed the victim in the case of Alex Brady. We called him a domestic terrorist, an assassin. Is there any standing for his family to sue Stephen Miller or other individuals in the administration who slurred their dead son for defamation?
It's a good question. And, you know, of course, Trump and his colleagues have used defamation laws. They brought ridiculous lawsuits like against 60 Minutes for their editing of an interview of somebody else. There are a variety of avenues for legal recourse for people who've been wronged by government officials. Stephen Miller is a government official here. Everything from what's called a Section 1983 action, where you can sue federal officials for violating your civil rights, and other things of that nature. I think that a defamation case of that kind is not impossible, but it would be difficult because we want to have robust speech and government officials get to do it too. And under the New York Times Sullivan case, there's really a lot of room for people to say even wrong things in political speech. There have to be some form of legal accountability, civil or criminal or both, for these government officials.
Civil is what they couldn't be pardoned for, correct?
They could not be pardoned for civil damages. They also could not be pardoned in the case of the people who shot Mr. Preddy, could not be pardoned for state murder charges. They can only be pardoned in Minnesota, should that come to pass. So there could be avenues of legal redress. There should be. The one set of people that we probably don't have a reason to expect to do it are the people in the administration.
All right. Well, that's certainly clear. And it does seem to me, though, that calling someone a domestic terrorist and an assassin is not the slip of the tongue. It's not an incautious mischaracterization. It seems to be a textbook example of intentional defamation from the bully pulpit of the government to justify a murder.
Right. To say it without any sense of evidence that it's the case. There was the instant reaction. You know, to just give a sense of how unusual and how outrageous the conduct is of the administration in this assault in Minnesota, the refusal to have a real investigation of these. There have been three murders in Minneapolis this year, two by federal officials. And that's an amazing fact. And the way this has kindled public anger, public outrage, a public movement of conscience, is really something to see in such a kind of compressed period of time. And it's happened before. It's happened before in our country's history. Obviously, most recently, George Floyd. If you think about Selma, the television broadcasts, or Birmingham, the television broadcasts of state brutality against people exercising their First Amendment rights there too, kindled real national outrage. Going back to, and this is the thing I want to kind of point you to, because I know you've written about this stuff, the Boston Massacre, which was also out of state forces killing protesters. And they went on trial. King George allowed an investigation and the criminal trial of the people who committed the Boston Massacre. And as you know, their lawyer was John Adams.
Yes.
They got the best lawyers they could get in Massachusetts. King George in the run-up to the revolution was more willing to have the rule of law apply than Donald Trump has been in Minnesota. And it really said something troubling.
It says they had a better version of a Mad King at the time. This show is sponsored by Rocket Money. Now, if you're like me, you might have too many subscriptions and too little time to track all of them. And if your New Year's resolution involves cleaning up your act financially, then Rocket Money is here to help. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel those unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Now, it drives me completely crazy when I realize exactly how many different streaming services I'm paying for but not actually using. Because, you know, those $16 a month bills add up over time. And that's one of the reasons why I actually use Rocket Money. It is very helpful for getting rid of unwanted subscriptions, for saving some money on the margins, to get a sense of how your P&L is looking personally. Rocket Money, in fact, can help you save hundreds of dollars a year when you use all the app's premium features. And they've saved users over 2.5 billion with a B, including over 880 million in canceled subscriptions alone, because they do it for you. The app automatically scans your bills, finds opportunities for you to save, and then goes to work to get you better deals. Get this, they even talk customer service, so you don't have to. That's worth the price of admission. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join rocketmoney.com/fixit. That's rocketmoney.com/fixit, all caps. rocketmoney.com/fixit. Thanks for supporting the show. Your new Brennan Center report, 9 solutions for political corruption. I think folks know the big 4 C's of dealing with Donald Trump's administration. It's the cruelty, it's the chaos, it's the corruption, and it's the cost. I mean, the corruption numbers are staggering, and I think folks have become numb to them. I mean, by some estimates, over $3 billion flowing into the Trump family coffers. But just the corrupt practice of giving pardons, billionaires appearing, you know, getting government favors, government appointments. You have 9 specific solutions. We're not going to have time to get through all of them. I want folks to take a look at them, but I want to hit on a few. One is something I've spoken to Larry Lessig about, but amend the Constitution to restore campaign finance limits. Why is this not pie in the sky, given the conservative tilt of the court?
I mean, dozens of states have already called for this very thing. For most of our country's history, we had the ability to regulate money in politics to make sure that people could actually run for office without having to be completely in hock to billionaires or others who pay for their campaigns. And it was the Supreme Court of the United States in Citizens United and in earlier cases, including one called Buckley versus Valeo, that wrecked the campaign finance laws of this country, that ushered in this dystopian and entirely deregulated money system. Where you have, for example, the world's wealthiest man at the time, Elon Musk, personally paying for the winning presidential campaign in 2024, and then moving into the White House, quite literally being given authority to wreck as many agencies as he could in a few months' time. It's like nothing we've ever seen. And so until we have a different composition of the Supreme Court, then a constitutional amendment is part of the answer. You can still do other things, as we talk about. You can still have a system of voluntary public financing for a matching of small contributions, just like we have in New York State and in New York City at the federal level. You could have federal legislation to end dark money, in other words, to require disclosure of all this big money that's being spent. And we also propose in this solutions plan, really making it illegal in a real way, which it is not now, for government contractors to be giving big contributions.
I want to dig into that one separately. And I do, folks who want to go deep in this, Lawrence Lessig, professor at Harvard, is doing a case right now. Go back and listen to that episode. It was around 3 months ago. And just to be clear, I, like Michael and you know, other folks, Jill Lepore, pointed out that while amendments are rare, they tend to happen in, you know, every 50-year increments, then a whole number of them.
Right. They always seem impossible, and then suddenly things get bad enough, and they come in clusters.
And I'm willing to be a guy who says that's what we should be aiming for. Don't give up hope on that. But I want to dig into one of those, one you just recommended, because these are all tied together. But banning big donations from government contractors. This is such a sickening epidemic that, again, we've become numb to it. You know, touch on the problem, but then the mechanics, how we fix it. How do we ban big donations from government contractors in a way that would be respected by an amoral administration?
Well, that's the question. So, you know, government contractors at the federal level, again, we're talking about it, it's about $755 billion every year. A lot of the money that goes from us taxpayers goes out the door at the other end to contractors to do things like build airplanes for the military and other important things. There is already a law on the books that purports to ban contributions, but it's more loophole than law. Executives can still give big contributions, subsidiaries can, and so on. And Elon Musk, who I just mentioned, of course, is a major government contractor.
Yes.
And yet spent close to $300 million in one race, which was the presidency. So you could emphatically have a law that basically applies the existing rules to the places where the real contributions are happening. And the Supreme Court has said that this kind of corruption is something that can be regulated. I have no false hope that they're on the level on these things, but this can be done. And it's basically done in a lot of state laws, for example. We just need to apply it to the Beltway Bandits and the others in Washington who, as they call them, who are government contractors.
And honestly, that's table stakes. I mean, in most states, you can't, you know, give massive donations if you're a beneficiary of government contracts from the government you helped elect. This is basic. It's common sense, and it should be done. And there are Republicans and conservatives who would back this if they weren't so terrified of Donald Trump. So this is something we should be able to get done. Let's talk about another thing that we should be able to get done, although it is written in the Constitution, and I've written about this pretty extensively. I mean, the stunning avalanche of corrupt pardons from this president to people who've been convicted of fraud, but also drug dealing, fraud is, you know, they keep reaching new lows, and evidence that donors give $1 million to get a pardon for one of their family members. How do you take away the president's power to issue corrupt pardons?
And this is a new one for the Brennan Center. This is part of this package on personal corruption and graft and self-dealing, everything from strengthening the ethics laws, creating a new ethics agency, and things like that. You're right. It is actually in the Constitution that the president has this pardon power. It is one of the things, one of the few things they just cut and pasted from King George III to the new American president. It was one of the powers the king has. Someone pointed out to me that means King Charles has this power, but I don't think he's used it in quite as corrupt a manner as Donald Trump.
It would be almost impossible.
It would be almost impossible. His uncle Andrew would get a pardon, but his brother. I'm sorry. Yeah, there's a real value in having mercy in the federal criminal justice system. It can be unfair. That mistakes can be made. It can be punitive. It can be racially discriminatory. We all know all of that, but this system has turned into an engine of corruption, and especially under Donald Trump, but not just Donald Trump. You see campaign contributors, people who seem to be giving crypto, you know, the mysterious pardoning of even as we're seizing Maduro, another head of state who was accused of doing the same thing. It gets a pardon. All of it can be covered up. And because of the immunity decision by our friends at the Supreme Court, you could literally pay Donald Trump for a pardon and he wouldn't get criminally prosecuted, but he would have the untrammeled power to issue that pardon. And so what we think you need to do, what we think we ought to do, is what's needed, which is a constitutional amendment to curb the ability of any president to make corrupt pardons.
How would you define that from an amendment standpoint? What would the language read?
You could do it a few different ways. I think these amendments work best when they are structural. When you say, well, the president has the power to make pardons, but they can be overridden by the Senate, or there needs to be a board of pardons that makes the recommendation of retired judges, or things of that nature. By and large, the most effective amendments have tended to be structural rearrangements that bring checks and balances and accountability or democracy into the system. There's other ways to do it too. You could say you can't pardon your family members, as Joe Biden did. You can't pardon your campaign contributors or others. I think those kinds of things run a risk of not being creative enough to think of the next scam and maybe easy to evade. But one way or the other, there are those kinds of things. And, you know, there's a precedent for this. Again, we want people to be able to appeal for mercy or for their sentence being unfair. Governors have pardon power, but always through some board of sentencing or other things where it's not just alone in the hands of the governor.
Yeah. You know, maybe they make a proposal to the board, but then, and using retired judges is something that makes a lot of sense. Codify the Constitution's emoluments clause. Now, it's a fancy word for basically saying that
the last syllable's there.
Well, yeah, that's right. But, you know, you're not allowed to give big, fancy gifts to presidents that could have corrupt intent or corrupt them. And yet, in Trump's first term, the Supreme Court essentially punted on the emoluments clause. And now they're drawing it. And that was before the immunity decision. And that never made sense to me, whether they were trying to hang it on a specific of the case involving the Trump Hotel. But you're looking at these billions of dollars that the Trump administration, the Trump family has enriched themselves from 1 year of a 4-year presidency. How do you think we can and should codify the Constitution's emoluments clause so it's got some teeth?
Yeah, so you're right that, you know, the Emoluments Clause is in the Constitution. It reflected the tremendous concern about corruption that the founders had, and in particular, their concern that presidents and other senior officials would be susceptible to gifts from abroad, from the old courts of Europe. They didn't think about having a plane come from Qatar, but it's the same idea. And it's in the Constitution, and the courts pretty much punted on this in Trump's first term. Now, in a way, it was kind of quaint what they were looking at, because the issue was whether or not people were using the Trump Hotel and things of that nature as a way to evade the Emoluments Clause. What we're seeing right now is far more direct payments,
yeah,
and far more direct corruption. So, you know, you could have statutes that very clearly say what is a violation of the Emoluments Clause, that that gives people the ability to sue to enforce it, that involves punishment if you violate it, all of which are things that are not really currently in the Constitution. The Constitution says it, but you need, as with many other things, you actually need some teeth in the law to make it work. So right. It's basically, if you were going to have a meaningful emoluments clause, how would you enforce it? That's what it would do.
All right. And, you know, we need that. I mean, again, we've never, I mean, Jimmy Carter put his peanut farm in a blind trust. I mean, I just think we are so numb to the level of thievery going on. And it's been greenlit by the courts, by the Supreme Court in the form of the immunity decision, but also the failure to enforce the Emolument Clause. But the founders clearly put in for a very good reason, because they were concerned about a tyrannical and corrupt executive. Final one I want to mention is, you know, it's been suggested as the Stock Act, but that members of Congress should be banned from trading stock. But you say they should also have their pay raised. Explain why this is on the level of the others. I think it does go to confidence in our representative government, however, because effectively insider trading is decriminalized, correct?
Right. I mean, members of Congress have a suspiciously, coincidentally, very high rate of return on their investments. They're doing rather better than the S&P 500. And they
not
are
coincidence.
You know, I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but they are privy to all kinds of effectively non-public information that's not covered by the insider trading laws now, the way it would be if you were an officer of a company or something like that. So there emphatically needs to be a meaningful ban on stock trading by members of Congress. And this is very popular across the board, Democrats, Republicans in the country. It's a huge embarrassment for Congress. The Democrats have begun clamoring for this. The Republicans just recently began moving a piece of legislation that was very weak in an effort to sort of hold this off. I think you're going to see, I hope you're going to see a bit of an arms race between the parties on this. The Democrats are saying they want to run on corruption, you know, broadly defined as one of their central issues now, and especially if they get power, and this has to be part of it. You're right that, and, you know, not everyone loves this, but members of Congress actually should get paid more. Right now, their pay has not gone up in a long time. They make less than their senior staff. They actually have to have two homes. And I think we need to look at a bunch of different ways to strengthen Congress, to make Congress have more public confidence. I think this is one of them. There are many other ways as well. But I think we shouldn't be afraid, those of us who don't have to face the wrath of the electorate, and saying they should, that these members of Congress should get paid more.
All right. Final thing, Michael, you got a lot of questions from folks. This is a time of high anxiety about how we as citizens can defend the American experiment. I want to divide up what your best advice is to Democrats about how we can institute the rule of law, because very often you hear a lot of parliamentary hand waving that says, well, we're effectively powerless until we're in the minority. And then as citizens, separately, what we can do to be a bulwark to help fix this before our country goes down in flames.
For starters, Democrats and Republicans too, in Congress and in politics and in public life, have enormous power to stand up. They need to use the tools that they have. I'm encouraged that, at least as of the time we're chatting, there may be pressure on the budget to deal with the response in Minnesota. ICE is funded by Congress. CBP is funded by Congress. We need those in power to understand that while this might not be a, quote, kitchen table issue, the way affordability, the way drug prices and the price of eggs and other things are, people are sitting at their kitchen tables and really are alarmed by their government attacking citizens and civilians across the country. They're alarmed by what's happening with their neighbors being targeted and immigrant communities being terrorized. So there are many tools that Democrats can use, and we also need Republicans to step up, as happens every so often. But Congress is a separate, coordinate branch. The founders envisioned it would be the leading branch of government. In recent years, in recent decades, it's just become either a cheering or a booing section for whoever the president is. That cannot remain. In terms of we the people, in terms of citizens, we have a lot of impact here. I even think that things like the No Kings marches helped change the atmosphere enormously. The election results, the number of people voting and how they voted, changed the atmosphere. I think it helps give courage to people to stand up to abuse of power. It helps give courage to courts to do the right thing. You know, what is so striking, I mentioned earlier things like Selma and Birmingham as examples from the 1960s, where the civil rights strategists and civil rights marchers knew that television might broadcast the brutality to the wider country and kindle people's conscience. And it's always been a question of, well, given the challenges with the news media now, how do you even do that? How do you get the word out? Well, now everybody's a cameraman or a woman. Everybody's got their phone. And what a difference it has made to have all that, all those images from Minneapolis, and just documenting. And we are all now, we don't have a Walter Cronkite, but we're all Walter Cronkite. And I think that that alone is something that can be really powerful in exposing abuse of power. We haven't seen it this way in this country before, but it is very inspiring.
The importance, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the ICE agents are perhaps most threatened by the sign of a camera. They don't want that.
By a phone. Isn't that something?
It is. And it says a lot. I want to ask you about one more thing that people are increasingly talking about. I'm not a big, I love historic parallels, but I think people need to be cautious about the Nazi parallels. You know, Hitler's Hitler. That said, there's talk about, well, what kind of whether it's Truth and Reconciliation or court cases for people who have violated the law at the behest of this administration, done violence to their fellow citizens. What kind of legal accountability can there be in this post-immunity world?
H.L. Mencken once said, conscience is the idea that someone somewhere might be watching. And I think that public officials right now have to know that Donald Trump will not be president forever. And that there may be legal accountability for illegal actions.
Both. What kind?
Well, there could be criminal prosecutions. There can be civil accountability. People can lose their law licenses. Statutes of limitation now run past the terminus of this 4-year presidency. And so there are the typical normal legal consequences for illegal acts. You could also have, and I think there utterly needs to be, a real look at what has gone wrong, partly so that we can enact safeguards and restore the rule of law going forward. And so I, for example, in a New York Times op-ed a few weeks ago, urged the creation of a select committee in Congress that's a special investigative committee, like the committee in the 1970s that was called the Church Committee. It wasn't because it was in a church. It was Senator Frank Church.
Yeah.
But that exposed abuses of power then by the CIA and FBI and against American citizens. I think the issues of abuse of war powers by this administration would be a good and proper use of such authority. But if Democrats or Republicans who want to do this, for that matter, get control of the House or of the Senate, part of what they need to do is really build a record about what has just happened, because it is not business as usual. It's not normal. It is authoritarian in so many ways that we are not used to in this country. And it's hard sometimes to wrap our minds around it. But more exposure and documentation is really vital to know what to do next.
Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center, thank you for the practical and bold and ultimately hopeful solutions your organization and you put forward. Thank you for joining us on How to Fix It.